Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing okay. Doing pretty good this week. Had a little tragedy that hit close to home over the weekend. But, you know, we're going to keep soldiering on.
Yeah, well, that's a part of life, unfortunately, isn't it? It seems we have these we have these wonderful holidays going on. At the same time, tragedy knows no season. So all the best to your family and friends there working through that.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
So, here we are on a Tuesday evening. I suppose I should say something about that. Appreciate those who have found us on Tuesday. I was explaining, Stephen, to you before we started here, because I very cryptically asked if we could do it on Tuesday this week. It's actually just my travel schedule this week is messing with me. I'm taking a late night flight to Boston in a little while, and I'm not quite sure what's happening tomorrow night. So I thought it'd be better for us to get a show in while we both had a free evening. And so I appreciate your flexibility, and everyone listening, I appreciate your flexibility for being with us on a Tuesday rather than a Wednesday. We've done a few Tuesday shows over the years. I think we've probably done more Thursdays than Tuesdays. Is that fair to say?
I think at one point we were doing it fairly regularly on Sunday night. That was our regular deal for quite a while, and we figured out at one point that at one time or another we have done it on every single night of the week.
We have, yes.
And Wednesday's been our pretty regular time for a while, but we tried it Thursday night and then other times, but seems like Wednesday works best for us almost always, so that's what we've been doing. So.
Yeah, I'd say Friday and Saturday are the rarest, right?
Yeah.
We've done the fewest then, and then there's a huge cluster on Wednesday. We've done some Monday shows, did a bunch of Sunday shows, but Tuesday and Thursday haven't seen too many of those. But I think a few more Tuesdays than Thursdays. Anyway, just the good part, as you pointed out earlier, is that anyone who shows up tomorrow night, they'll find a show. Right, it'll be there, and they just won't have this. So here's to you, friends, who've joined us on Wednesday evening. Thanks for being with us. We actually recorded this last night, so you're always welcome, though. That's the thing. In fact, if you're listening to this on Thursday, we're very pleased to have you with us. In fact, if you're listening to us in the year 2057, thank you for joining us here on Fast Forward Radio. Always delighted to have you tune in. I mean, that's why we record them, right? So that
Absolutely.
Posterity will have these programs for us.
Okay, I'm going to just throw this curveball at you, Phil. Today is the centennial of something. Can you guess as to what this is the 100th anniversary of?
Is this the sinking of the Titanic?
Not the sinking.
Oh,
the launching
of the Titanic.
The launching of the Titanic occurred 100 years ago, 9:30, England time, Southampton, England time. The Titanic was launched today, 100 years ago. So.
Wow.
5 days from today is the sinking. So.
Oh, okay. So that's coming up on Saturday. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. Anyway, that's interesting. It seems like, you know, as a kid, it was talked about, you know, like it was ancient history. But 100 years, I mean, it seems almost surprising it's not longer ago than that, doesn't it?
I mean, it's that is a thing that throughout my life has moved from something that was a thing that happened a long time ago to something that was just part of history, kind of like World War One, right?
Yeah.
Went through this transition of something that was part of living memory to something that is no longer part of living memory. And it's interesting because we had that huge Titanic craze at the time that the ship was discovered back in the 80s, and then another big craze in the 90s when James Cameron's movie came out. And now here it is, actually the centennial of the Titanic, and it's fairly muted, isn't it? I mean, there's not really a lot of hoopla about it, which is kind of interesting. Maybe we've made our peace with the story of the Titanic at this point.
Yeah, not too many more stories to tell, perhaps. I don't know, but
that could be a big part of it, actually. Yeah. You know, also coming up this week, I mentioned in one of my posts over on Better All the Time is Yuri's Night is coming up. Is that, I think, tomorrow? Actually, is Yuri's Night. So had we not rescheduled the show, we would have been doing it. We would have been doing it on the day itself. But that's always one we like to note, the first human being in space back in, gosh, what year would that have been? 1959, 1960? I don't know. I'm not sure. But Yuri Gagarin's historic flight, anniversary of that coming up. So everyone mark that day in some space-related way. I think we'll probably be talking about space a little bit this evening as we get into our topic. And in fact, Sputnik, which is the anniversary, that's October 4th. Now that was 1957. That date I remember. Sputnik is a really great example of these leaps into the future that we're going to be touching on. But before we do, have we covered all of our preliminary stuff this evening?
I think so. Why don't we jump on into the
jumping? Sometimes we just naturally leap into the leaping. So I wanted to talk about the kind of uneven path that we take into the future, and I picked this picture just because I look at this image of this guy. You saw the picture I put up on the blog, and it's also running here on Blog Talk Radio. I can't tell if that's real or not. Do you think that guy's really jumping from the one rock to another, or is that just a Photoshop job?
I think it's possible. The guys that do that sport, and you know, they do the rooftop stuff. It's incredible the things they do. They actually do. So that one might actually be real.
It looks to me, for all the world, like he's not going to make it. Is one thing I'll say about that picture. And also, he doesn't seem to be dressed appropriately for what he's doing. You know, he's kind of dressed up a little bit.
The guy that was flying with the wings that turned out to be a hoax. You know, that one took me in, by the way. I was
completely sucked in. I only started thinking, you know what? It was funny because I was watching that and I was going, you know, this is cut a lot like that walking on the water thing, but this one's real. I was actually thinking, isn't that funny how, like, this one's real, but it, you know? So I'm easily sucked in.
You're
by
going off in your head and you just ignored it. You ignored your spider sense, Phil.
My spider senses were tingling and I did not deal with them appropriately. But I think twice bitten, okay? I'm really, the next time some incredible YouTube shows up, I'm just not going to believe it, okay? No matter what it is, I'm just going to say, no, it's a hoax, okay? That's why I'm suspicious of this picture, right? Everything I look at my face, I go, is that really me? I don't know. That's, you know, I'm just not sure about any of this stuff.
Well, you know, think about it. This grew up in a world where if you saw a picture of it, it was real, you know? I mean, it was
jackalope or something like that, but anything that was as elaborate as that would have been real, right? You know, value would have equaled reality, right?
Right.
There was a time when you could count on that, and now you can't.
You just can't.
Because they'll go to any level of trouble. Anyway, I like the picture because he's definitely on a discontinuous path there. That fellow traveling from one rock to the next rock is not experiencing a smooth transition from one stage of his journey to the next. And I think that this kind of leap is probably more normal and more to be expected than we think. We love to think of things occurring as gradual transitions. And I think there's a place for that in our understanding of the natural world. Some things do happen gradually. You know, the seasons change gradually. You know, plants come up gradually. You know, there's a lot of stuff that does actually happen over a course of time with a little bit of change and a little bit of change and a little bit of change. And then some other things are more cataclysmic, or if not even cataclysmic, just very definite and binary. And one of the examples I would give to this is really the radical change that has taken place over the last few decades in how evolution is understood. At the time Darwin wrote Origin of Species, the model that he projected and the understanding of evolution that existed for a century or so was one of one species gradually over time, you know, would mutate, change a little, mutate, change a little, mutate, change a little, and would become another species. And that all began to change, I think it was probably in the early 70s, with Stephen Jay Gould, and I can't think of who his collaborator was on that, and I'm not going to make the click-click sounds as I Google it real fast. I'll just talk through it. But Stephen Jay Gould and another important biologist, I can't remember who it was, when they first proposed the idea of punctuated equilibrium, this idea that, in fact, evolution occurs with long periods of what they call stasis, long periods of a species remaining virtually unchanged, and then very sudden, very rapid changes occurring, and a species diverging into two different species in a rapid period of time. It happens quite quickly. And in fact, this is one of the reasons that you don't get the so-called missing links to the satisfaction of those who would, you know, who would want to see all the stages in between one species and the next species. If everything were happening gradually, then you would expect the fossil record to have all the intermediate stages between species. But what happens is there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of generations where they're exactly the same, and then just a very few generations where radical change occurs, and then hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of generations where they're the same again. And so mathematically, what do you end up with? Well, you end up with a few samples of when they were the same on one side and when they were the same on the other side. So you kind of get gypped out of getting your missing link fossils. And you also, I think, get frustrated in your expectation that things are going to happen gradually, when in fact, biologically, what is now understood to happen is you have a rapid shift from one state of being to another, and one species emerges, the other one disappears or splits off in a completely different direction. So I think that's one good analogy for understanding. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say Niles Eldridge was his collaborator. And,
thank you.
Did you name the theory? It's called punctuated equilibrium.
Punctuated equilibrium. I meant to say that if I did not. Yeah.
Yeah, you may have, but a good, you know, there's the example of the moths back back in England, you know, when they were burning all the coal, they had these moths that were kind of light in color, and they were, and of course, with all the coal being burned, all the trees and all the buildings and everything else were being, ended up with coal dust on them and were getting darker and darker in color. And these moths were standing out, and were getting eaten by their predators, and then within the course of a very, very short period of time, all of them are dark, matching the coal of the building, you know, the coal color of the building. And the thing is, it was just a single mutation. One moth had the happy luck of being born dark, and so there wasn't any intermediate stages. You know, it was just, and then all the moths that managed to survive were its descendants, and so they all were darker, and it was just boom, overnight went from light to dark.
So there you see the change occurring essentially in one generation, although it probably took a few generations to build the population back up. But even then, moth generations aren't, I'm guessing, not very long.
Pretty fast,
So
it seemed like it was overnight.
Yeah, so suddenly you see that change occur really fast. That's a great example of the kind of thing you're talking about, and that goes to show it doesn't have to be cataclysmic. We think about, you know, some things, if they're going to change, it's got to be. I mean, the landscape can change if you have like an earthquake or some horrible thing happens. But actually, you just introduce a new variable and everything changes, right? Suddenly. Things that had nothing to do with survival have everything to do with survival, and the traits that weren't important before suddenly become massively important, and suddenly a major shift can occur when none was even necessarily expected.
Well, and here's the thing, I'm sure that mutation had showed up from time to time in years prior, but it gave no evolutionary advantage. Let's say you're a moth with a light color, and basically the color of the trees, and there's this baby moth born, or come out of its cocoon that's dark, then that moth will get eaten quick because it would show up against the light background of the tree.
It was
the right mutation for the right moment. That changed the color of all the descendants after that. So, they might be white again now.
Yeah, they could be. They could have had the occasion to switch back. So actually, that would be kind of interesting.
If that ever happened
on the mega scale, did we ever see anything like from chimp to human back to chimp? Right, that would be. That would be an interesting progression.
Let me suggest to you, I've seen that before. I'm just kidding.
I can give you some venues if you want to see that transformation occur rather rapidly on a Friday evening, actually. But I got to thinking about this when I first heard about punctuated equilibrium. This is just an aside. It's not really related to our topic. But speaking of evolution and speaking of punctuated equilibrium, first heard about this in high school in advanced biology class, and that's interesting to me because in that year, the Kentucky State Legislature passed a law saying that in all biology classes where evolution was taught, the teachers also had to read the creation account from Genesis. So it was one of these we see similar things happening in different states from time to time these days. It's never like this anymore. It's usually there's a move to get intelligent design in or something like that. But basically the same struggle that has occurred over the years, which I think is silly and pointless. But it goes on. Anyway, what was interesting about that was the guy who was teaching that advanced biology class was also my fifth grade Sunday school teacher. So, small town, and these roles kind of overlap. So it was interesting because, of course, he was like totally not impressed by the fact that he had to read Genesis. And, in fact, we had to read King James Version. There was like a very specific set of rules about what had to be what had to be read
there. American Standard Version would not have been good enough. Okay, all right.
No, it was not. not the Living Bible, which was huge back in those days. No, it had to be King James. So we got the creation story from the same guy who was teaching us Stephen Jay Gould and punctuated equilibrium. And to me, I think that's interesting because a lot of times when you see these things being discussed, there's this kind of hysteria about it, Oh no, they're going to teach intelligent design to kids in Kansas and they'll never learn any science and civilization is going to crumble, I mean, reality is actually a lot messier than people tend to picture it. And I mean, the perfect example is when you have your old Sunday school teacher who's been teaching you evolution, he has to stop for a while and read you the Bible, and he's not very happy about it. And
he would have loved to have read that to you on Sunday morning, but
exactly.
That wasn't the time or the place. He
didn't feel it was the time or the place Monday through Friday in an advanced biology class. And what was really funny was he was making commentary as he went, you know, he can't help it. He's a Sunday school teacher. He's going to make little asides as he goes about the story. And it occurred to me years later, it all sounded perfectly reasonable at the time, but it occurred to me years later that theologically he was way off. A lot of the stuff he was saying was just not correct, like Orthodox Christian theology at all. So I felt like, man, the legislature really shot themselves in the foot with this law, okay? Because this guy was, you know, he was having a bad attitude about it anyway. And then on top of that, I don't think he was quite undoing the damage that they were hoping he would undo. You know, I don't mean any criticism of him. I don't know if he's still with us. He probably doesn't listen to Fast Forward Radio, but I would take issue with several of the things he said.
It sounds great. That's one thing I've struggled with as particularly as a younger person. You know, I mean. You know, it's an interesting dichotomy, particularly for you, that you had your biology teacher for your Sunday school teacher. I love that. I love the picture.
Yeah, it all sort of worked out. But to me, the great lesson learned there is that I people worry a lot about this, and I don't think it's that big a thing to worry about. You know, I think people take way too seriously. I think people think that kids take what they're hearing in school more seriously than they actually do. I think we have, looking back on myself at that age, and I would say any kid I know in the interim, probably have a little more of a filter around what they're hearing from their teachers than we give them credit for. They're, you know, often kind of picking and choosing what we're going to. And I don't just mean in biology. I mean in any subject, right? You know. The teacher gets going, and you kind of go, well, yeah, I can see that, but I'm not 100% sure of everything this person's saying. So if anything, to me, it was great that they passed that law because I came out of it with this wonderful story. You know, and also I think a really good example of the strange dichotomy that can occur. But anyway, we push on now from my creationism in public schools in the 1970s story. So punctuated equilibrium is one example. I'll give one more example, and then we'll jump into some leaps that are occurring in the world today. And this one comes from physics. If you have ever read much about how atoms work, you know that the electrons are in orbit around the nucleus of the atom, right? Well, there are multiple orbits, depending on the atom, that electron can be in, right? It can be in this position in this orbit, or it can be out here in this one, or it can be way out here in this one. And when we think of, like, planets orbiting a star, there's a big difference because an electron can actually move around, right? So it could be in Jupiter's orbit, and then it can be in Earth's orbit, and then it can be back in, like, Pluto's orbit, right? Not that Pluto's a planet, but you see what I'm saying.
It actually has a
but it's got an orbit, so you know you get the idea.
Yeah, I do.
But the difference is if when we picture planets doing that, if we say, okay, well here's Earth, and it's in Earth's orbit, but now it's going to be back in Jupiter's orbit. We picture Earth, you know, physically moving through space from one orbit to the next, which is actually how it would happen. But on the atomic scale, that's not what happens at all. It's one of these quantum effects, and you're either in one place or you're in the other place. There is no transitional place for you to be. There's no such thing as being somewhere between those two orbits. And this is a big part of what quantum physics is all about. You're either in this one or you're in that one. And again, this is just an analogy. I'm not saying that that our experience of the future actually works like that, but in some ways, it's a little more like that than we give it credit for. That just like these rapid transformations that occur within species and evolution seem to come out of nowhere and just overwhelm the process as we understand it. I think sometimes we move from one state to the other, essentially in no time. Right? It just boom. It happens.
Well,
and you're the next stage.
Can I play devil's advocate just a little bit with
of
this?
Of course.
Back in college, I had a history professor who, one of his favorite sayings was, "History makes no sharp turns."
Mm.
And I said, "Well, you know," and I just, you know, being the kind of guy that I am, I raised my hand and said, "Well, Professor, I mean, you know, what do you say to things like the moon landing? I mean, at one moment, you know, everyone lived in a world that no one had ever been to the moon, and then thereafter, everybody lives in a world that where someone had been to the moon." And he said, "Well, you always have to look closer. They didn't just decide one day to get up and go to the moon. It was a long drawn out process." And you know, it may be under the surface where you don't necessarily see it. You know, there's things that lead up to every great change that go on that may take a long time, and people don't even realize it until bang, it hits. And so that was his point.
He makes a good point, because you could throw out a lot of those, right? Pearl Harbor, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that felt like an awfully sharp turn to the people who lived through it, right? These big cataclysmic, catastrophic things that happen all have antecedents leading up to them. Although, you know what? I wish we had him on the show, because I'm going to challenge him. What about the tsunami back in 2005, right?
Well, yeah, any natural disaster would be a great example of, you know,
that's just
that,
like a boom.
Bang,
yeah. 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 Or like those big extinction level events back in the back in prehistory. But I think your professor makes a good point. And while I'm arguing for this understanding of how things occur and how we get into the future, definitely there is an understanding of how we get there that's built entirely on continuous processes. I mean, this is the Kurzweil with the law of accelerating returns. That is one long, continuous, gradual process going all the way back to however far you want to take it, all the way back to the Big Bang. Although, if you look at the Big Bang, that's a pretty sharp turn, right? I mean, so you can argue it either way. I think the important thing is to understand that there's something to be gleaned from both of those models, because definitely,
I believe so.
There are periods where we hit what the biologists would call for a species stasis, where it seems that things don't change all that much. I mean, we've talked about that interesting phenomenon where a person from, say, the 18th century, the founding of the United States, could go back and live in ancient Rome, or somebody from that era could come and live in the 18th century, and there'd be a few little adjustments they'd have to make. But they could pretty much recognize and get along in that world, even though it's 2,000 years difference between them. Whereas you take somebody from the 18th century and you put them in this world, right? I mean, it's the staggering changes that have occurred, right? Huge leaps forward that have been made because of first the Industrial Revolution and then on top of it the Digital Revolution, and then we've got these like social media revolutions occurring on top of that. So in some ways, I think that there's definitely a model of stasis occurring, and we break out of it.
Right.
And well, let's look at a few examples. What's your top big leap forward that you wanted to bring out this evening?
Well, and I'm going to use this as a leap forward to both demonstrate my professor Tankersley was his name. It sort of represents both his idea that nothing happens overnight, and also things happen overnight.
There you go.
The internet. Here's the internet. For most people who live through it, you ask them when the internet showed up, and they say, "Well, it was about 1991, 1992."
Right.
You know, bang! All of a sudden, we have internet. Of course, we had to dial in, and it was slow and cranky, and it was not anything like the internet we have. So it was awesome. I mean, we went from no internet to bang, we've got it overnight. And because I'm interested in these things, I began studying, okay, exactly when did the internet start? It turns out the year I was born, 1969, the first two nodes of a ARPANET were connected. And so that was really the birth of the internet, was the year I was born. And I did not log on to the internet until after I was graduated from college. You know, I mean, I did not really even have a clue what the internet was until well after college. So it was overnight, but it was also something that was growing exponentially, And as been pointed out many times on this program, exponential growth in the early stages, it looks like nothing at all. It
right.
just hits like, you know, bang, overnight, and it changes the world. So I guess that's probably my best example I can come up with. It both demonstrates, these giant leaps and, given a nod for Tank, that it was not exactly overnight. It was under the surface for a long time.
Well, and it also that also speaks to another principle, which is sometimes the moment arrives. You know, the thing is, the internet was around for quite a while, but the explosion occurred when two things were happening at roughly the same time, or actually two things happened in fast sequence. One was the introduction of the personal computer, and the
right.
other was the introduction of the World Wide Web. You combine those two things with the fact that the internet had already been there for quite some time, and suddenly you get the explosion. It's like the tumblers all fall in place, and everything's able to take off. To use another example from biology, this is kind of like what happened with mammals, right? People think
yeah.
that there were dinosaurs way before there were mammals, and then mammals showed up after the dinosaurs were gone. Actually, mammals coexisted with dinosaurs for millions and millions of years.
Yeah.
And it was only after a series of extinction-level events wiped out the dinosaurs that that we came along, you know, that we like rallied. It was like our moment, and suddenly, okay, dinosaurs are out of the way. Now it's like our turn, right? So something that has like a potential that has lain dormant for some time, waits for exactly the right tumblers to fall into place, and then suddenly, boom, you have this explosion of change. I think the internet is a really good example of that, and it goes back to what we were talking about last week with Spock's chessboard. Sometimes you need all of the accelerators to be there at the same time in order for things to happen, which is why history has unwound more or less the way it has, and why we didn't have things like steampunk, right? It's why, you know, the real reason we didn't go to the moon back in the 1850s or something like that is because all the other parts weren't there, and you didn't have enough momentum to make the thing accelerate and make the thing take off. Things have to be ready to happen. But what's amazing in this era is we got so many things happening that we're not even in a good position to predict what's ready to happen anymore. The things that are coming next are so fast and so numerous that it's hard to get a good handle on what's coming next. Although, having said that, this is a unique position. I'm not sure that anyone anticipated the explosion of the internet until it was actually happening. I don't recall anyone predicting that becoming a huge thing. I mean, you read things like it in science fiction from time to time, but I don't remember anyone saying, yep, the internet's going to be huge and everybody's going to be on it all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody did, and whoever did, they were a genius. But maybe Kurzweil did. He probably did. But
Arthur C. Clarke came pretty close in this video I watched recently. He was talking, it was 1972 or something like that, and he's talking with this father who has this little boy with him, okay? The boy's like 4 years old. And, you know, and Arthur C. Clarke is like, you know, tussles his hair and says, you know, by the year 2000, he'll have his own computer in his home, and
right.
He'll be able to log on and buy theater tickets. And I mean, just went on and on and on talking about all the stuff we do,
right.
You know, it was pretty remarkable. Arthur C. Clarke, had a genius for that. I mean, he's the one who foresaw, of course, the, geosynchronous communication, satellites and all
sure.
that. So yeah, just a brilliant, brilliant man. So there's a
not,
few
not
who
only
saw
foresaw
it,
but really helped, put the thinking in place that made it possible. I mean, he was a participant in that.
Yeah.
However, while we're on the subject of Arthur C. Clarke, he's also the guy who predicted that we would have a functioning moon colony by the year 2001, and we'd be sending
right.
manned voyages to Jupiter by then.
It
although that was
in
fiction.
It, you know?
Well, it did seem possible. So, I mean, that might be the other side of this is that it's always dangerous to extrapolate, right? Either we think the line is going to be straight, and we expect to be here when actually we're going to be much farther along, or we expect to get to a certain place, and we don't realize is that we're not following a smooth line. We're actually leaping from one thing to the next, and this would actually be, I think, space exploration is probably a pretty good example of something that we're doing in leaps, not in the continuous progress that we expected. Because to your point, I think everybody in the late 60s, early 70s expected that we were going to follow a continuous arc that was going to involve further exploration of the moon, settlement on the moon, exploration of the planets, deeper exploration into the planets, colonies elsewhere out in space, and ultimately, you know, somewhere a century or so or more down the road, interstellar travel, that by this time, you know, decades and decades after that first moon landing, that we'd be well into planetary exploration, if not settlement. But we didn't follow that line.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say that there's a big, huge reason for that, and the reason is the lack of reusability of our spacecraft. Peter Diamantis, I believe, is the one who was talking about it. He said, you know, think about it. How much flying would you do if every single flight that was made, if the red eye you're going to be taking a little bit later, Phil, was destroyed at the end of the flight. You know, you made it to your destination, but the plane was destroyed. What do you think a ticket for that kind of ride would cost? And so the key to opening up space and making it real, a place that we can go, a place that we can go and actually make money, you know, completely reusable rockets, where the only thing that's lost in getting us there is the fuel, and every other piece can be reassembled and flown again. That's the key, and people like, you know, SpaceX are really working on that problem, and it's
yeah,
that's cool.
It's a good point, and it goes back to your to the discussion we were just having about the internet. It has to do with it's like the next leap can occur when the stuff falls into place, and it's amazing what has actually occurred. Sally's asking in the chat room, well, did these science fiction writers back in the 70s, did they overestimate how far we'd be in space and at the same time underestimate how far we would go with computers? Actually, I think what they underestimated on the computer side was how deeply they would be embedded in our world and in our lives. I think that's the part they missed out on. Actually, if we stick with Arthur C. Clarke, he gave us HAL by the year 2001, right? So he was giving us a human level artificial intelligence by this year, and we haven't by 11 years ago, and we're still not to that point. So I don't think that they underestimated either arc. I think they were pushing hard on all frontiers as they should have been, but definitely didn't see the extent to which our culture would become completely wrapped up in this technology. Our commerce, just our entire lives would be completely wrapped up in that technology. If anything, they would have thought that the space technology would have been the technology that our world was going to get completely wrapped up in. And in fact, we stepped away from it for the reasons you just stated, which was that the way it was set up was a bit of a dead end. Economically, it was not sustainable. So we were able to pull off this incredible leap of being unable to travel into space at all, and within a decade of that, landing people on the moon and bringing them home. An incredible progress over this tiny little period of time that occurred. It's a great example of a big leap that could not be followed by a nice arc of continuous progress that almost had to taper off at that point. Because we needed a new model to emerge. We need the economy to change. We needed material science to come along. There's a whole lot of different pieces that needed to come into play. One of the things that makes SpaceX possible, and the X Prize that makes the whole idea of private exploration of and private settlement of space feasible, you know, Bigelow idea of putting a hotel in space, is that the world's a lot richer now than it was 40 years ago. There are individuals who have not only the wherewithal, but actually the resources to make something like that happen. And that was completely impossible 4 decades ago. The richest man in the world could not launch his own space program, right, in the 60s, right, or even in the 70s, right. And I don't think even in the 80s. Things had to change. When I say, you know, people are richer, I don't just mean that there's more money, but I, you know, the whole cycle that we talk about of empowerment that's occurred through technological development, the whole idea that small groups and individuals have tremendous leverage that they never used to have, makes it possible for us to be making this kind of leap now, and I think that I think we're heading for another huge leap in space, and I don't know if things will taper off there or if we'll follow a steady arc from there. It's going to be really interesting to see how that works out.
Absolutely, I thought what Sally put in the chat room just now was pretty awesome. She just got finished reading Robinson's Mars trilogy. Is it I think that might be Red Mars, you know, Green Mars, Blue Mars, whatever. That might be that trilogy. I think that's what she's talking about. She says
okay.
It's published in the mid-90s. Also are cool space stuff and space tech were talked about, but people are still watching videotape 100 years from now.
Right. Or is that what points out here? How about the mechanical readouts on Star Trek, right? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah,
I love
they
that.
Just. You know, they just
it's
got
hard
it wrong.
To get it
I mean,
all
they,
right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the propulsion technology is really fabulous, but everything else is just is just pretty whack. And if you're not looking at information technology developing along the Moore's Law line, if you haven't incorporated a little, you know, Werner Vinge or Ray Kurzweil into your thinking before you start trying to tell a story about what's going to be happening 100 years from now, you end up pulling those kinds of making those kinds of mistakes, and it really is interesting to read. I mean, obviously you can read vintage science fiction, and their ideas of information technology are just ridiculous. I mean, it's so far off. But you can even read, as Sally's pointing out here, technology that we think of as really modern. You know, is just from a few years back, and they get it wrong. I mean, they get it they get it pretty disastrously wrong. Not to beat up on them so hard, they get it wrong because it's really hard to see how fast things are happening. That's actually a good measure of how rapidly these things are changing. Because probably at the time those books were written, you'd read that and it seemed perfectly plausible that in 100 years there'd be videotape. But now that's just, you know, obviously. It's unimaginable to me that anybody's still using videotape, right? And
even the succeeding technology, DVD, and even Blu-ray, you can see the end of even Blu-ray as people just you know, get rid of the discs altogether and whatever they need. So you know, it's a new world all the time.
Absolutely. Well, I'll give you one more example from my end, and I wrote about this on Better All the Time yesterday. I found that story that you had mentioned, I think, a couple of weeks ago. The new book by what's his name? Dyson, not Freeman.
George Dyson.
George Dyson.
Freeman's his dad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talking Dyson.
About the fact that. Not metaphorically, but in a very real sense, that the digital world is its own universe. And I was reading his that's one of those things. It's kind of like the idea of the singularity itself. You hear it once or twice, and you know it kind of rattles around and go, well, that's kind of interesting. That's kind of odd. I read that a couple of quotes in an interview over on Kurzweil with him last night, and I had to reread it like 3 or 4 times before I really let that sink in and say, that is profound. You know, that is really huge what he's saying. And I think he's absolutely right.
Repeat it for our audience, exactly what he was saying.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to not even try to paraphrase here. I'm gonna read just a little bit. He says, here, this is George Dyson talking about the digital revolution. He says, what we're missing now on another level is not just biology, but cosmology. People treat the digital universe as some sort of metaphor, just a cute word for all these products. The universe of Apple, the universe of Google, the universe of Facebook, that these collectively constitute the digital universe, and we can only see it in human terms. And what does this do for us? We're missing a tremendous opportunity. We're asleep at the switch because it's not a metaphor. In 1945, we actually did create a new universe. This is a universe of numbers with a life of their own that we only see in terms of what those numbers can do for us. Can they record this interview? Can they play our music? Can they order our books on Amazon? If you cross the mirror in the other direction, there really is a universe of self-reproducing digital code. When I last checked, it was growing by 5 trillion bits per second. And that's not just a metaphor for something else. It actually is. It's a physical reality. To me, this is just one of those great aha moments that you get every now and then. It's a wonderful part of being alive. I think it's a wonderful part of being interested in the future, because we look ahead to this coming incredible transition that we call the singularity. This moment when the greater than human intelligence emerges, whether that emerges as a human being or whether an artificial intelligence that's smarter than us suddenly takes off and the future, the world becomes fundamentally unpredictable. But the beginning of this universe, the beginning of the universe we live in, the Big Bang, is itself a singularity. The emergence of a universe is a singularity. And when you look at this entity that we're completely immersed in, that completely surrounds us, that completely drives so much of what we do, and understand that it is a new universe that has sprung up very recently. I mean, in cosmological terms, it has just sprung up. We're basically in the first few seconds of this thing existing. As far as we know, the only other universe there is. There may be lots of universes. There may have been just the one. But now there's two. There's actually another whole entity, an entity unto itself that includes these, as he talks about, numbers that are reproducing themselves, that are going somewhere. We look at it as a set of tools that we've created for ourselves, because that's what we were trying to do. But if we step back and look at what it actually is, we see something very different. And what we see is something startling and new that has emerged in the world, and I think that people haven't even begun to come to terms with it. But that thing, that new universe, is what's going to produce the singularity. It's what's going to completely change this universe. I think that the two are completely bound up with each other now, and whatever is going to happen to it is going to have a huge impact on what's going to happen to us, and whatever is going to happen to us is going to have a huge impact on what's going to happen to it. And so if you think in terms of our journey into the future occurring in leaps rather than as a gradual transition, what Dyson is talking about there, this thing that occurred in 1945 when suddenly we created this digital infrastructure, this whole new universe, is probably as big a leap as any we've ever taken.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this little bit of a side, Phil, but I read views of Turing's Cathedral before buying it. I'm trying to see if this is something worth reading. And of course, it's been an awesome book. I highly recommend it. Turing's Cathedral is one you should. Anyway, I was reading the reviews, and the only criticism anyone leveled in the reviews, it was funny, was that the title was misleading. They hardly talk about, Turing is like just barely mentioned. And here's the thing. Turing, in the 1930s, laid down the architecture of how to build this thing, basically, okay? And it was von Neumann and others who, a decade later, actually accomplished it, who built it. And it's really von Neumann's story more than anybody else's. But it's just a, I, was an interesting criticism, but it hardly mars the book at all. It's a very great book.
I'm going to have to I might download that tonight and I'll read it on my late night flight here. Actually, I think that would
be a great idea. You'll enjoy it. I certainly have.
Perfect way to spend a long flight. Okay, so that's like, you know, you think about the singularity, or you think about just the emergence of the whole cyber world, and some interesting discussion starting over on Singularity Network where I posted about that Better All the Time piece. Just one comment I have to share here. Archie Robertson wrote, "New universe, my arse. That's just sales talk for the cyber manufacturers." that's a great comment, because you know, yeah. Well, if it's just marketing speak, of course it would appeal to me, right? Naturally, but
yeah.
But an interesting comment under that about whether you could really ever have anything more than one universe. And I know that I've gotten into this issue with Michael Anisimov on this program once before. You know, whether it's okay to talk in terms of there being multiple universes, or whether whatever exists is all part of the same universe. That becomes an interesting semantic discussion. But what I'll say to anybody who wants to disagree, not with me, okay, you're disagreeing with George Dyson here, okay, not me, you know, disagree with me all you want to. Give Dyson a better way of putting it, right? If that's not the right way of saying it, that would be my challenge. What is the right way to say it? And I think he's completely nailed it. That something major has occurred here, but not every major thing that occurs is of the profound cosmological scale. So let's explore, Stephen. What else we got? I think we have a few other quick ones we might touch on before at least one more before the show ends.
Well, another one that's sort of on par with how fast the internet showed up was cell phones.
There you go.
One minute nobody had them, and the next, or if they did, it was some big backbone they had plugged into their car. And the next minute, we all have them in our hands. You know, I think we had these, what was it, the razor? And if you couldn't quite get that, then, you know, there's these Nokias that looked like a smallish brick, sort of. But it was, it went from something that only the elite had. Gordon Gekko had that brick. It really looked like a brick back then. And
yep,
everybody just oohed and aahed over that in the late 80s to something that everybody had in the late 90s, early 2000s. And nobody oohs and aahs over them anymore. So, you know, how did we get along without them? You know, Phil, I laugh and I said, well, you know, I'm old enough to remember how we got along without them. We just spent a lot of time wondering where people were. I wonder what they're doing. You know, you don't wonder so much anymore. If you care enough to know, you can find out. You know, so cell phones.
I was watching Mad Men the other night on Sunday night, and that occurred to me. There's a scene where, they work in an office, and it's late Friday, and something has just come up, and one of the partners walks into an office, and he's got to talk to this copywriter, and he's gone. Right, it's like it's Friday.
Yeah.
You know, he's not there anymore, and it's like this guy desperately has to get something done by Monday morning, and you know, back in those days, you could just go completely off the grid till Monday morning, right? I mean, if he went home, you might catch him at home on his phone, maybe, but he could have gone anywhere. You know, the idea that people could just be completely out of touch for days at a time is something that the business world had to deal with. You know, back before cell phones, and it's almost unimaginable now. It's like we get bent out of shape if we can't get a hold of somebody for 45 minutes. You know, it's like, why didn't you answer my text? I texted you. You know,
this whole we don't need to get into the racial politics of it, but George Zimmerman, the guy that was involved in the shooting of Trayvon, his lawyer fired him today, and here's the thing. He said, I don't, you know, no longer can work with him because I have not been able to communicate with him since Saturday.
You mean to say he fired his lawyer?
No. The lawyer says, I can't work for a man I can't contact. I've been, George Zimmerman's been out of contact with me since Saturday.
Well, Saturday or Tuesday?
Are you kidding me? Yeah, I mean, it's Tuesday morning, dude.
He was out of touch for 3 days on a holiday weekend. Yeah, there it is. I mean, it's like
I can't work for this guy. Yeah, I go, what? You know, it's a different world. It really is.
It really is. That's the world that that technology has not only enabled, but it's kind of forced upon us. We can't tolerate the inaccessibility of others. So some people, I think, do their best to be as inaccessible as possible because it's kind of a last way of sort of remaining an individual and kind of establishing your own space if you can stay off the grid a little bit. I know I can't, and I can't stand it when I can't get a hold of somebody. Although I think being feeling like you just can't work with somebody because you haven't talked to them since Saturday and it's Tuesday is a pretty extreme example. But you know, before we wrap that's just to take this home, that is another great example of a technology whose moment arrived, because you know, cellular mobile technology existed since the 1930s. People had had phones in their cars going back that
far. We have to make the distinction. We had mobile technology. Cellular is much more recent.
You're right. I shouldn't have said cellular. But we had car phones that were radio phones and that worked off you didn't have that rolling from one cell zone to the next, which was a huge breakthrough. And in fact, that was one of the breakthroughs that enabled the explosion of mobile technology that we have. The other one being microelectronics and computer technology, which and the falling prices of those, which, you know, it's just like the perfect storm. All those things combine at the same time, and then you suddenly have this world where everybody's on their BlackBerry or their iPhone or their Droid all the time, right? I mean, if I didn't have it in my pocket, I'd be sitting here, you know, checking on things while you and I are talking. But I have to wait another couple minutes until the music stops playing because I think it's time for the music.
I believe it is. Our music tonight is by John Tagliari and TAG. So this one's Make Me Believe.
Making Believe, what did you say?
Make Me Believe.
Make Me Believe. All right, well, thanks. I like the name of that. Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for putting that together and for indulging me on a Tuesday evening. Thanks for all of you listening in the chat room, listening live, everyone listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again next week at the John Smart is coming into town next week, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to work this, but I'm hoping to have him on the program. So stay tuned for late-breaking bulletins on what the program is going to be like next week. But I'll put something up on the blog and look forward to being with you all then. Until next time, live to see it. Face.
listen, me.